When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Now, have you ever heard of Dickie Chappelle? No, I hadn't either, but I'm delighted to bring you the unknown story of this trailblazing female war correspondent. Dickie's career started in World War II, where she reported from some of the Pacific War's toughest battlefields of Iwo Jima and Okinawa. During the Cold War, she reported from Hungary during the 1956 uprising and was held in the infamous Foe prison and interrogated by the Hungarian security forces. Dickie went on to report the struggle of the Algerian Liberation Front, covering their campaign against French colonial rule, as well as becoming the first Western female reporter to march with Castro's Cuban Liberation Army. I speak with author Larissa Reinhardt, who's written a new book about Dickie Chappelle called First to the Front. There's links in the episode information where you can purchase the book. I'm delighted to welcome Larissa Reinhardt to our Cold War conversation.
She's special to me in particular because I learned about her first when I was actually in high school. And I would go down to the local record store and I would buy a CD, right? And one Saturday, I remember I bought this album by Nancy Griffith, who's this incredible folk singer. And the album is called Clock Without Hands. And on it is this song called A Pearl's Eye View. And it's about Dickie Chappelle. And it's about how she would fly in planes and jump out of planes and do whatever it took to get the story. And so from, you know, a very formative age, I internalized Dickie Chappelle as a folk hero of mine, right? She lived with me for a long time. And I never really thought to write about her or even look further into her life because she was a folk hero that sort of just exists in this other realm. But then when I was doing my master's degree and I was writing about the audio letters, the cassette letters that GIs would send back to the States from the Vietnam War, I came across her name again. And I hadn't really thought about her in a long time. And it just conjured up all these memories. And I started looking into her legacy more and more. And I realized two things. One, that she was incredible, that she had made such an amazing contribution to the field of journalism and also Cold War history. And that, two, no one really knows about her. And I really felt the need to change that.
Why is she missing from the pantheon of female journalists?
That's a great question, right? Because we do have this incredible pantheon of female journalists, and people are knew about them and are really starting to rediscover them. But I think that Dickie had three strikes against her. One, she was a woman, right? Like that alone sort of comes with its own challenges in terms of historical preservation. And then two, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but during the Cold War, she wrote about people outside of the United States, people of color, people around the world who were fighting against communism, who were giving their lives, sacrificing so much in the fight for freedom. And a lot of her reporting was about them and valorizing them and their efforts. And she was also very critical of American foreign policy and its lack of support of these struggles. And I think she didn't have a champion to continue that charge. And finally, this might be problematic to say, but she was very anti-communist, right? She was adamantly against communism from the start and vocal about it. And I think a lot of academia at the time had shied away from that stance. And then moving on, a lot of anti-communists were painted with the same McCarthyist brush, right? And I think she fell under that unfortunate categorization, which was not who she was. So I think, you know, it took a lot of unpacking to really find who she was and her true voice and her true legacy. And I think that's why she's very much absent so far from the historical record.
How did she get into journalism?
From the beginning, just sort of, you know, from a very young age, she was a daredevil. She loved to fly planes. When she was a teenager, she got a job at the Flying Circus in her hometown of Sherwood. And her parents were not a huge fan of this and packed her off to live with her grandparents in Miami, where she then got another job at a flying circus. And this was really right on the cusp of World War II, right? This was 1939. She was reporting on the Havana Air Show just at the moment that Hitler was seizing power. So she moves to New York City to actually be an assistant to TWA. And she is there when Hitler invades Poland. And so she decides to take her combined skill of writing and aviation knowledge and write about the F-3F Grumman plane, which was sort of the top of the line military plane being rolled off at the time. And she is the first journalist to fly in one of these planes as they're trying to sell them to the Allies before America enters the war. And that was published in the New York Times. So this was really, her review was published in the New York Times. So this was really her entrance into journalism. And then, of course, World War II follows soon thereafter. And she just knew that she wanted to be part of that history, that she wanted to contribute. She wanted to contribute to the war effort. And she saw journalism as her opportunity to do so.
She does, and I'm probably jumping forward ahead here, but, you know, there's loads in the book. So there's no way we're going to cover everything here. But she manages to be with the U.S. Marines on Okinawa and Iwo Jima, which were some of the most ferocious battles of the Pacific War for the U.S.
She kind of made her way by hook or crook to Iwo Jima, right? She started in Alameda Hospital in Oakland, and then she got permission to go forward from there. Forward from there was Pearl Harbor. Then she got permission to go to Guam, right? And so she's doing her best to follow the progress of the Pacific Ocean Theater. And then finally she gets permission to board a hospital ship. And in World War II, women were not allowed in combat. In fact, they were only allowed to be where women were already. And what that sort of tautological statement means is that she had to be where nurses were. So she could be, you know, in field hospitals and hospital ships. And, you know, these people were also putting their lives on the line. There was a great deal of danger. Of course, we know the USS Comfort was bombed by a kamikaze plane. And so Dickie really wanted to be at the center of action. She talked her way on Iwo Jima to the front. And I think this was D-Day plus nine that she was there. And so you don't have this, what we often recognize as the quintessential scene of Iwo Jima, which is the amphibious landing. Instead, we have just men in foxholes in the sand for days and days and days fighting for their lives, which is a harder story to cover. It's a harder story to convey because it's a lot of waiting and it's a lot of fear. It's not a lot of action. But that's what she covered and that's what she saw. And that was her first experience of war, I think, which is more true to the reality of war than perhaps what we are exposed to as civilians. So she came back. She went back to the hospital ship, sort of very much changed by that, and with a greater understanding of the scope and scale of war and its stakes. And then, you know, she was with the fleet at the end of Iwo Jima. And she then talked her way again onto Okinawa, which was such a different situation because the Japanese army had fortified themselves within Okinawa's extensive capes. It wasn't the same sort of amphibious landing drama that we see in Iwo Jima. It was more of a protracted battle. And so she was there. I believe she got to Iwo Jima on like D-Day plus three, and she was there for a week. But she was also there on the day that the Japanese army revealed herself on April 16th. And then she had to leave because, again, women were not allowed in combat, and she had sort of talked her way there and also impressed a number of military personnel who made exceptions for her and the, you know, generals and colonels who were on the ground. But the press officer, the admiral who was a press officer in the rear area, decided that she had to go, that she couldn't be there, and that she should be stripped of her press credentials because she had broken the rules. And so she had to leave, and she had to find her own way out because the military was, the Marines were otherwise engaged, and she very graciously made her way aboard an LCVP boat that took her, you know, back to the fleet. Well, this happened to be on April 17th, which was the first of several concentrated kamikaze attacks. So she was on a ship as, you know, hundreds and hundreds of kamikaze planes were assailing the fleet for, I believe it was 36 hours. And so, again, this was her introduction to war, her introduction to reporting, and she was in it completely from then on for the rest of her life.
That sort of impressing military personnel and being allowed to go where she perhaps shouldn't be going is sort of like a quite a constant theme in her story. And I think one of the scenes, and there's many sort of like lovely scenes in the book, but one of the bits I remember, and it, she's either on Okinawa or Iwo Jima, I think it's Okinawa, and she's taking some photos from a hillock, and there's this whistling going on, and she's like, oh, I've no idea what that is. I'll just keep taking my photos.
Yeah.
And it's the Japanese firing at her.
Yes, yes.
And it's her early naivety of what it was like to be in combat. Obviously, going forward, as she becomes more experienced, she knows to keep her head down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, luckily, you know, she survived it. But yeah, she described it as the sound of wasps all around her because there were just bullets flying by her head, and the lieutenant colonel who had driven her there was incensed, but also somewhat charmed, both by her naivete, but her willingness to learn, and her desire to be there and record and to document, you know, their experiences.
So post-World War II, she works as a documentarian for some international aid organizations. But one of the many stories I wanted to talk about was her experiences in Hungary in 1956. So there's a revolution in Hungary where there's an attempt to overthrow the Soviet control of the country. And so the freedom fighters fight this communist regime. Dickie is there to cover the humanitarian crisis for Life magazine. So can you tell me about some of her experiences there?
She went to Austria to cover the just waves of refugees that were coming over the border. And she was so inspired by the Austrians who, you know, were building these enormous bonfires as beacons for refugees to cross the border. And of course, this is a story that speaks to our own moment. And this is the middle of winter. And so the tundra is, you know, absolutely freezing. And then, so she's, you know, interviewing the refugees that have made their way over, and she's interviewing the Austrians who are helping them. And then she's standing on the border, right? And there's not a wall. It's just sort of, you know, where Austria begins and Hungary ends. And these two students run across the border. I mean, and they're in regular clothes. And Dickie follows them. And what they're doing is that they're finding refugees who have lost their way, who have been understandably frightened by machine gun fire that is sort of spraying at all times to keep refugees away from the border. And they're bringing them over to Austria in these last few hundred yards. And so Dickie begins to do this every night, and she is joined by several other journalists, including James Michener, who was incredibly impressed by her bravery. She was the only woman there, of which I am aware, but I believe she was the only woman there. And together they helped shepherd hundreds of refugees to safety. But eventually she decides that this, you know, this isn't enough, that she wants to actually go into Hungary to cover the continuing fighting that is occurring as the Soviets are in the process of overthrowing a democratically elected government. But unfortunately, she is arrested by the Hungarian secret police on the way and taken to Fow Street Prison, which was the most infamous prison in Budapest. And if you went there, you know, the understanding was that you would be tortured. And she was very much aware of this because many of the refugees that she had interviewed had survived this experience. So she knew exactly what she was heading for, which is sort of even more terrifying, I believe, than some level of ignorance.
And she has quite a rough time there. She's put in solitary there. She can hear a guy being beaten up in the next cell, screaming. They try and remove any sense of time, so meal times are really erratic. And she's interrogated a number of times to try and sign a confession as to, I think she's accused of being an agent of imperialism or something like that.
Yeah, so she, you know, she was not accorded any special treatment for being an American. You know, she was in solitary confinement for the better part of 6 weeks. She was in complete solitude for an entire week. You know, no one spoke to her. Her food was passed through a Judas window in the door. She, you know, was fed on a starvation diet. She lost, I don't know, 30 pounds in 6 weeks. She lost hearing in her left ear. Though she was never physically tortured, she was threatened. She was threatened with it several times. And she was told that if she didn't sign the confession, that she would be raped by her male guards, tortured, and then hung. She survived and endured all of this. And it really changed the way She understood tyranny and communism in a way that I don't think a lot of other white Americans at that time had the capacity to comprehend or empathize with, because she knew what it was to lose her American citizenship. She knew what it was to live under a communist regime. And so she knew fully the stakes of the Cold War.
She's suffering PTSD after this experience, as you would imagine you would. And she has some time sort of recovering from that. But I think that this sort of sets in her this burning desire to cover these human stories. I think one of the differences with it is she's very much interested in the human side of things and not big picture journalism. And the only way to capture the human side of things is to be there and looking people in the eyes.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, at the time, big picture reporting was sort of the, you know, norm of the day, right? And what we mean by that is, what are the generals doing? What are the heads of states doing? What are the policy initiatives? Not who are the people on the ground, boots on the ground, enforcing these policies, and who are the citizens that are being affected by these initiatives. And so those are the stories that she was interested in covering and that she went to extraordinary lengths to cover. You know, and you mentioned that when she got out, she was suffering from PTSD. But on the other side of that was this burning desire to get back out into the field. And so soon thereafter, I mean, I think it was just 8 months after her release, she went to Algeria to cover the Algerian War of Independence against the French, because she wanted to present to the Western press a different side of that conflict and present to the American people the true story of the people who are fighting that war for independence.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more. And this is an interesting story to cover because it's a ally of the United States, effectively occupying a country that now wants its independence. And so there's this Algerian Liberation Front who are fighting the French. And in fact, her journey into getting into seeing them is quite difficult. I mean, it's like 3 days on foot, mule and horse to get in there. And then once she's there, she finds herself under bomb attack from American-made aircraft, albeit being flown by the French.
Yes, exactly. She is, you know, up in the foothills of the Atlas Mountains, and she's with the Scorpion Battalion, who is sort of, you know, the FLN, the Algerian Liberation Front's special ops, right? They're, you know, they've blown up more French train tracks than anyone else. They wake up. She wakes up after she has finally gotten, you know, to their camp. She's drinking her coffee, overlooking the, you know, the hill that she has just, you know, mountain really that she's just summited in the dead of night, you know. And they hear a plane coming in, and she recognizes it immediately because it's a plane that she heard in World War II. And she knows it's an American plane. And so she and the rest of the Scorpion Battalion take cover, you know, in the rock formations. And I think it was an hour that they're just listening to it circle. And she can see through her viewfinder that it is loaded with bombs. And so finally, you know, it flies off. It doesn't see anyone. And then, you know, as they're, you know, firing their weapons in celebration that they've, you know, lived to fight another day, they hear the bombs go off. And so her guide, who's a lieutenant colonel in the FLN, takes her to where it has dropped. And they have dropped bombs on a Bedouin village, you know, civilians. And she finds an unexploded bomb. And it has, you know, markings that indicate that it was made in America. And so there is no doubt in her mind that America has aided and abetted the, you know, war crime of killing civilians within a combat zone. And so, again, this really changes her. This changes her opinion of what it is to be a patriot, of what it is to fight for American freedom, and what it is to be on the front lines of the Cold War. And it affects her approach and her opinions moving forward as she continues to cover the evolving, you know, battlefields.
I mean, how difficult did she find getting that story published in the US? Because she has various challenges about some of the subjects she covers.
You know, she did. Okay, so when she was in Algeria, she was writing for the Spaida Syndicate, who was a small syndicate, right? And these are the only people who would, they were competitor to the AP, right? So they put out articles and then they're published in local newspapers across the country. But they are a very small competitor and they are the only people who would sponsor her coverage because none of the big players really believed that she could get the story or even that this story mattered. So because she was, in a way, flying under the radar, she was able to get that particular story covered. And then another thing that she did was she would really couch her criticisms in dramatic stories, right? So she wrote a story about the execution of an Algerian who was a collaborator with the French. And because this had a certain sense of violence to it and drama, a male magazine, a man's magazine called The Grossi published it because it would have this sort of, you know, machismo appeal. But within that article, she also worked in these more critical, you know, points that were critical of American foreign policy. So she was able to circumvent some of the obstacles that faced her, one by, you know, working with smaller distributors, or two, by sort of, Emily Dickinson says it, right? Tell the truth, but tell it slant. And I think Dickie was a master at that, of finding what people would want to read and then let it, putting in what they needed to hear within that.
And how's her relationship with Tony, her husband, at this point?
They are divorced at this point. You know, just to sort of backtrack, she married Tony when she was 19 years old. He was 41, I believe. You know, and he was silver-tongued, experienced, vet, World War One vet. You know, he was an aerial photographer in the Navy, and then in World War II was again recruited to teach a new generation how to do this. And he was a great photographer, and he was a brilliant developer, right? This is alone is an art. But he was also an alcoholic and later a drug addict and a very controlling partner who did not want to see his wife exceed his success, which she very much did. And so she reached this critical juncture where she could either stay married or, you know, live the life that she wanted for herself. And she chose the latter. And she really never looked back. And never had a serious relationship again. You know, women continue to struggle with this, but in a way that pales in comparison to that time where you could be a wife or you could have a job. And she wanted to have her career and not the career of a housewife. That being said, I do want to mention that she had a complex view of motherhood. She went out of her way to praise and really talk about women and mothers doing traditional women's work in ways that were heroic, because she viewed them that way genuinely. And she also knew that there was no revolution without domestic labor. And so she wanted that to be part of the historical record, part of her journalism as well. You know, she was covering the anti-Castro militias in Miami later on. And she said of one of the wives that there was a place in Valhalla for her because she got the kids to school on time and, you know, swept up after the boys made the bombs in the sun deck. And she's right. So anyway, but that wasn't the life that she wanted for herself.
Well, I mean, the mention of the Cuban exiles is a good point to talk about her next location she was at, which was Cuba before Castro takes power. She's the first Western female reporter to report with the Cuban Revolutionary Army. But I particularly liked her trick in terms of getting into the rebel area when she really shouldn't be there. Do you just want to tell us about that?
So, yeah, Dickie was very resourceful. So she first flew into Havana, which was no problem because, you know, Havana is still, you know, America's casino and no one's going to question a, you know, white woman flying into Havana. But then she has to get to Santiago, where the bulk of the fighting is happening. And interestingly, and I won't go too much into this, but Santiago is also where the sugar industry is centered in Cuba, which is the economic center of Cuba. So it makes sense that Castro would be attacking this area first and foremost rather than sort of the more tourist industry of Havana. So she gets there and Batista has just dropped a total dragnet of information and, you know, alerted the police to jettison anyone suspected of being a reporter. So she lands and is immediately questioned by the police that why would an American woman be interested in coming to Santiago? You know, it's surrounded by bandits. There's not enough to eat. Why are you here? But what was in Santiago then and now is the Guantanamo military base. And so she tells this police officer that her lover is stationed at Guantanamo and that she just has to go, she has to go see him. And he, you know, just sort of smiles and it waves her through. You know, in the meantime, she's like joining up with the, you know, Cuban revolutionaries on the golf course to walk into the Sierra Maestros. But yeah, that's how she gets into Cuba. Yeah, I don't know if a man would be able to pull that off, you know, like I think she really leaned into being a woman for that one.
It's a brilliant story and it shows her ingenuity in terms of getting into places where she's not supposed to be. And one of the stories while she's in Cuba that I found fascinating is she finds a U.S. Marine serving with the Cuban Revolutionary Army, which is quite an interesting little story.
Yeah, so Jerry Holthauser was really a Marine at Guantanamo, and he was, along with several others, kidnapped by Raul Castro, Fidel Castro's brother. And the purpose of Raul doing this was to show the Americans that no one was safe from, you know, the Cuban Revolutionary Army, that they had complete control over the country. Now, they weren't harmed in any way. They were fed. You know, if it was raining, the prisoners would sleep inside while the, you know, Cuban Army would sleep outside. And Jerry started asking them, you know, why are you fighting? Why are you doing this? Because, you know, again, Batista was an American ally. Havana was this playground for, you know, Americans. It just seemed like there's no problem. And a lot of people compare Batista to Mussolini, right? The trains ran on time, the streets were clean, but only if you're in Havana. So what they began to tell Jerry was that, you know, there's this incredibly brutal infrastructure of secret police throughout Cuba that would arrest and torture and kill tens of thousands of Cuban civilians in order to maintain their power structure. And it didn't matter if you were a man or a woman. It didn't matter if you were an adult or a child. You know, if you raised your voice against them, they would come for you. And so Jerry was very affected by this, and eventually Raul released them, you know, back into American custody. And several weeks later, Jerry decided that he wanted to fight for freedom. That's why he had signed up for the military, to fight for freedom. And so he hopped the fence of Guantanamo and joined the revolutionaries. And so that's where he was. And he fought for the entirety of the revolution. He stayed in Cuba afterwards. But then what happened with Castro happened with Castro. And because he was against communism, because he was against dictatorship, he had to basically flee Cuba back to the United States, where he was court-martialed and convicted and dishonorably discharged for deserting.
The U.S. Marines is a constant theme in this story, because at this point, Castro is an sort of ally to the Soviet Union. He's fighting Batista. There's an appetite for change in the country. And so he is seen by some in the West as a positive influence. Obviously, there's a number of people in the U.S. who want to keep Batista in power.
So there's sort of this triangle, right? There's this trifecta of the Cuban Revolution. There's Che Guevara, there's Raul, and there's Fidel. And Raul and Che were very outspoken against America and Western imperialism. And Fidel was somewhat more diplomatic about it, I think because he was trying to court that. And he succeeded in a way. You know, the CIA purportedly and probably did hedge their bets and fund Castro's army to a certain degree. What Dickey wrote about before and after the revolution was that America needed to support people fighting for freedom, the Cubans fighting for freedom, for their independence, which was, in her opinion, their birthright, or else they would go and find support where they could. And that meant the Soviet Union. And she was very adamant, and this is sort of down to the nitty gritty, but part of what kept the, you know, Batista regime afloat was sugar subsidies and imports by the United States. And Dickey was very vocal about the need to continue those subsidies and imports from Castro so that his government would have the money to succeed in its vision, which at the time was to rebuild Cuba, to support the farmers, to break up the large-scale Western farms that had sort of benefited from these oppressive policies of Batista. And when the U.S. cut off this market opportunity, Castro did exactly what Dickey thought he was going to do, which was go to the Soviet Union and get support from them. And, you know, this was a pattern that she saw repeating throughout the Cold War, was countries would come to America, ask for support, America would deny it, and then they would turn to the Soviet Union.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information. She met Castro because she was invited into his command post. What did she make of him?
So she, interestingly, knew from the start that he was a bit of a megalomaniac, that he was a demagogue, that he, and she very famously said, he is better when he has an enemy. And so someone like that always needs an enemy. And when you win the war, who is your enemy? The enemy is the people. And that's what he did. He turned on his people. And she was not, she was impressed by the people who fought with him, who fought for the for Cuba's independence. But she was not, she didn't have a great deal of faith or trust in him. And she hoped that the movement that had grown around his charisma would carry the day. But unfortunately, that was not the case.
After the Cuban Revolution, she's also involved in the Bay of Pigs, or she gets wind of the story there and flew to Key West. And I think this is one of her first experiences of US or CIA censorship of her stories.
So this is really when the Cold War gets murky. So she goes down to Key West, and she's actually in the same building where she worked as a teenager when she worked at the Flying Circus in Miami. And she goes into this, you know, office of the Cuban expats who are, you know, trying to stage a, you know, incursion or what have you. Against Castro, and the carpets are new, and the paint is fresh, and there's, you know, indoor plants, and there's an expensive mimeograph machine, and this young man comes off the mimeograph machine, which costs thousands of dollars, and he says, "Oh, hi, Dickie, I recently read your report," and she just knows immediately that this is not a ragtag, you know, revolutionary group, that this is funded by the CIA. And so, you know, this guy who's posing as an assistant is clearly, you know, a CIA operative. And he shows her into the press office, and the press officer tells her, "Oh, you don't want to go down to Cuba. You want to go here, 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 and here." And she tells him, she goes, "You know, you got to get this guy out to the front desk. He's really giving you away. Like, I know what's up. Anybody who comes in here knows what's happening. Like, this is the CIA." Who she had various run-ins with throughout her career. But so she doesn't listen to him at all. She immediately rents a plane and starts, you know, hanging out over the side as she started her career doing, and taking photographs of the naval fleet assembling. And because she is of that World War II era, right, she takes her film down to the naval press office, and she says, "Here's my film. Let me know what I can publish," because she still believes that the American government will do what is best for the American people, and that she puts her faith in them, and she does not want to jeopardize America or Americans in any way. And what she is told is that she didn't take this film, she didn't take these pictures, there is no fleet assembling, and that you better forget that you ever took them, because you didn't. And there's no infrastructure to censor them, because there's nothing to censor. And, you know, this was really, there's nothing to censor because it didn't happen, right? They're not saying, "Oh, go ahead and publish them." They're saying, "You can't publish any of this," and it didn't happen. And this is really the beginning of an attempt by the Kennedy administration, and then moving forward from that, the American government, to control and contain the information coming out of various fields of combat within the Cold War in a way that differed from her experience of World War II.
She gets quite upset because she does discover one of her photos appearing in a Navy publication, doesn't she?
So this is jumping forward a little bit, but in 1961, right, she couldn't photograph the Cuban Missile Crisis. She tried to get to that as well. She was planning on paratrooping into there, but that didn't come to fruition. So she goes to Laos, where there's a secret war happening, where the CIA is staging at the time, where it's arming and training, you know, mountain peoples in Laos. And she's with a special ops, White Star Special Ops, under, I believe it was the Aragon program. And she, you know, knows them. She did a jump over South Korea and marched to the DMZ with these guys earlier in, I believe, 1959. So they know her. She knows them. They know that she can handle herself in a combat situation. And so she lives out there for like 2 weeks or something like that. And interestingly, because this war is undeclared, there's no real infrastructure for controlling what journalists go out there and what they're reporting on. So the only question that she's asked before going into this, you know, sort of secret war is, will you eat bats? Because if the supply lines are cut off, you're living on whatever is out there. And she goes, yes, sir. So he's like, okay, go ahead and have a blast, kid. So she goes out there and she lives with them, and she's photographing them fighting the Viet Cong. She's photographing them also firing back. And she takes her photographs. She takes her article. She submits them to military censorship. So she saved this. I mean, this is fascinating little tidbit, but she saves a draft edited by military censorship. And they say to her in this draft, this does not jibe with the original story. Please change to make sure it follows what the military wanted to say, basically. Because she said that they were, you know, in the American special ops were in combat. And according to the Geneva Conventions of French Indochine War, they were not allowed to be. So she changed it, but she saved that draft. And then she submitted also her photographs to army censorship, and they were lost. You know, they just couldn't find them. And she appealed, I believe, all the way up to the Joint Chiefs of Staff to try and get them back. And, you know, they couldn't find them, couldn't find them, couldn't find them. And then, as you mentioned, you know, I think 6 or 8 months later, she gets, you know, the Navy Journal. And she finds one of her photographs, of course, unattributed, that she had taken there. And, you know, once again, she writes to try and get her photographs back, but she is absolutely stonewalled. And so that was really the last time that she inherently and unquestioningly trusted the military to allow her to report on what was going on. And again, you know, moving forward, she had a very different opinion, not of her relationship with the boots on the ground, with the guys doing the fighting, but with the people who were in the offices telling her what she could and couldn't say.
Yeah, one of the things I was surprised to see is she is sort of considered as an expert in guerrilla warfare. And even the US military are asking for her opinion on various operations.
Yeah, so, you know, she was one of the only Western reporters in Algeria. She was one of the only Western reporters in Cuba. And there was not, you know, military intelligence presence there to any large degree. So she has already that knowledge base that is rarefied at that time. You know, I didn't get to write about it in the book because a lot gets left out, but she was also in Beirut in Lebanon, ahead of the Marine landing there as they attempted to and were successful in thwarting a coup attempt in that, you know, civil war that was brewing there. So she saw those two factions fighting at that time. So she really had a lot of knowledge about guerrilla warfare going into the Vietnam War era, more, I would say, than most, because again, right, big picture reporting is still the style of the day where she has been on the ground all these years. And so as we head into Vietnam, the Vietnam War era, the Marine Commandant asks her for a primer on guerrilla warfare because he wants the Marines to know what they're getting into, right? Because it's well known that the Viet Cong are a formidable guerrilla army. So she, you know, arrives in Saigon, 1961, and she is talking to the MAG, the military advisors that are there, many of whom she knows. Just to backtrack a little bit, you know, throughout her career, she would report on training of the U.S. military in order both to keep abreast of what they're planning to do and where they're planning to go next. And so she really has a relationship with a lot of soldiers, of service members. So, you know, they're going out to dinner and getting drinks and talking to them about what is going on. And she recognizes all the telltale signs of a guerrilla war happening. She doesn't even have to go out into the field yet. And she also recognizes that America is losing that war because it is not even engaging in the battlefield. And she suggests to them in 1961 that they get out of, you know, they stay, they have a presence in Saigon, but that they need to go out into the villages. They need to live in the villages. They need to eat what the Vietnamese are eating. They need to help them plant their fields. You know, they have to engage them as allies. And she says, if you don't do this, if you don't treat them as equals, then you will lose the war, and you are losing already. And this is 1961. And she couldn't have been, you know, more prescient or more correct in her assessment of the situation.
There's one scene in here where she comes across some U.S. troops guarding some Viet Cong prisoners and reprimands the soldier that's in charge of them. And this is against sort of like a quite a rampant anti-Asian racism that's sort of like permeating the U.S. forces at that time.
So Dickie spent a lot of time with the South Vietnamese armed forces. She jumped with their airborne. She patrolled the Ho Chi Minh Trail with the Marines. She, you know, was embedded with the army and also, you know, in the Mekong River Delta with the Navy. And she recognized them as brave and willing to fight. And also they weren't being well trained by their American advisors, and they were not being supplied and equipped accordingly by America. And she saw this narrative perpetuating itself that the South Vietnamese were not fighting, were not good at fighting, and were not willing to fight. And she pointed out, you know, you say the Vietnamese can't fight. Well, the Viet Cong are kicking your butt all over the map, and these are the same people. These are oftentimes the same families, you know? Like, many people who fought with the Viet Minh are now fighting with the South Vietnamese army. And then on the other side, the Viet Cong, these are the same people. They are willing to fight. They can fight. You're just not allowing them to fight. So the other part of it is, you know, she had herself been the prisoner of despotism. And so when she saw America behaving in this way that violated the human rights of a suspected Viet Cong agent, she was incensed because she knew that if America engaged in this kind of tactic, that they would lose the war, and they had lost it already. You know, and one of the things that Dickie really understood more than most was that a war is determined for the kind of peace you are fighting for. And if the kind of peace that America was fighting for was a violent peace, then they would never win. And so she vocally stood up to this particular lieutenant colonel in the field. But then she was also very vocal in her opposition of this treatment of the South Vietnamese to, you know, the Joint Chiefs of Staffs and the Marine Commandant. She pulled no punches, and she said, there is no basis in reality for your treatment, and it will only cause you to lose.
I mean, she's in her 40s, I think, at this point. How well known is she in the US? Is she known?
She is getting more well known. You know, she does write for Reader's Digest. She's now writing for National Geographic. She published the first photograph of Marines in combat in South in Vietnam in National Geographic. You know, she was heralded for this photo and won multiple awards for this photograph, and deservedly so. So, yeah, I think she was starting to get this kind of acknowledgement that she deserved as we headed into the Vietnam War era, you know, the post-1965 period of the war.
Can you take me through November the 2nd, 1965, where she's back on patrol with her beloved Marines?
LBJ has just recently authorized the deployment of combat Marines to Vietnam. And Dickie is once more, against all odds, hopeful that America is finally joining the fight for freedom for all people around the world in the same way that she had seen her country do in World War II. And she knows what she's up against, but she's also been talking to a number of, you know, people within the government and within the military. And she has herself drafted this strategy of friendship, right? And it sounds so naive and it sounds so simplistic, but it is really a genuine idea of winning the hearts and minds of people, of actually joining people in their quest for freedom and self-determination and as allies and as friends. And she feels she's getting some traction with this idea. And she's not necessarily a pacifist by choice. She understands that guns are necessary to fight for freedom. So she joins the Marines in July, which is near Da Nang. And it is one of the first sweep and destroy missions of the war. And she falls in line, you know, with the Marines, as she is so used to doing. And the young man in front of her steps on an improvised landmine. But because it's improvised, right, it doesn't go off immediately. So he lifts his boot and she is lifted, you know, some 20 feet in the air. And she had said to a friend just the night before, "When I die, I want to be on patrol with the Marines." And that's where she felt she was at home, and that's where she felt she was needed. And so she lands, and she has, you know, multiple lacerations, and the chaplain, you know, rushes over to her. They're not even that far from the base, and she whispers to him, "It was bound to happen." You know, she's been in war. She's been in combat for 20 years. Most soldiers don't survive that long in combat. And she dies on the way. She's being to a helicopter to the Chulai hospital. And, you know, I think she was lost too soon. I think her reporting would have made such an impact on that time and on that place. But she also died the way that she wanted to go. And after her death, the Marines honored her as one of their own. She was given a military honor guard at her funeral. You know, they played taps, they folded the flag for her. Not, you know, very few civilians are accorded this honor. And there is a plaque in Chulai that reads, "This is where Dickie Chappelle fell. She was one of our own and we miss her." So You know, she was tough on the Marines. She was critical of them, but it was from love. And they understood that, because more than anything, she believed in them. She believed in their cause. She believed in their capacity. And she believed in, you know, their better angels as she believed in those of America. So,
Larissa's book is called First to the Front, The Untold Story of Dickie Chappelle, Trailblazing Female War Correspondent. There's links in the episode information where you can purchase the book and support the podcast.
Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.